running audios to allow for sound quality. Anyway, we are ready to go. This matter is, the attorneys have been here before. I want to remind you that all rules of appellate procedure continue to apply, although we're doing this by Zoom Gov. You do not have to stand. That's the only relaxed rule, unless you feel more comfortable doing that. There will be a, as you can see, at least in my upper right-hand corner, there is a large time clock. Pay attention to the time. This is a very deep file, but you still only have 15 minutes apiece. 5 minutes is reserved to appellate counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use that. Please state your name and indicate what party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your argument. I'll direct our marshal, Jack Fink, to go ahead and call the first case for hearing.
Now calling case number A200709, Mark Lanterman, Computer Forensic Services versus Michael Roman Afremov.
Mr. Singer, when you're ready, go ahead.
Thank you, Judge, and good morning, and may it please the court, Craig Singer representing Michael Afremov. The trial of this case was supposed to be narrowly limited to the question of what damages should be awarded for breach of contract on a single invoice. This court's prior decision disposed of everything else, but the district court allowed CFS to tell the jury in detail about Mr. Afremov's wealth and about the criminal charges against him, which had nothing to do with the amount of damages that should be awarded. On the issues that were relevant to damages, the district court excluded Afremov's only expert witness, even though CFS's expert was allowed to testify on the same subjects. And instead of limiting the trial to one invoice, as this court directed, the district court allowed the jury to award damages on a second invoice. Contrary to CFS's arguments, each one of those points was preserved for appeal because all of them were argued in motions in limine prior to trial, which preserves the issue as a matter of law under Evidence Rule 103A. And all of those arguments were also raised in post-trial motions, and the district court decided all of them on the merits without any question as to waiver.
Well, Mr. Singer, I'm going to upset the order of your argument right away. I'd like you to focus, if you would, on the assertion you're making that there was an abuse of discretion by Susan Burke as far as the remand from the Court of Appeals, the prior panel. Of course, you have to show an abuse of discretion, and what are your highest points? What are your most salient points saying that she abused that discretion?
Sure. Well, Your Honor, the court specifically remanded for a new trial on the first invoice, and that was not random. That was not a slip of the pen, and in fact, the court referenced the first invoice twice in its opinion. It was a result of the court's reasoning in reversing the original judgment on the first trial. And that reasoning was based on a note that the jury in the first trial sent to Judge Bush asking whether it, the jury, could award certain damages on the first invoice. And Judge Bush said no, and this court's opinion held that that was error. He should have said yes, and that required a new trial on CFS's first billing invoice.
Well, except that the reversal, the remand for a new trial is a new trial. And the error that the first trial judge heard, Judge Bush heard, had to do with the invoice number one. But because of that, there were many reasons to send this back, including the fact that there was a determination that there was an actionable a cause of action that was permitted on unjust enrichment. So how do we get by the judge just not saying we have an entire trial we're redoing?
Because that's not what this court said. I mean, with all respect, I mean, I think that this court might have done any number of things, but that's not what it did. The court, in fact, threw out the unjust enrichment claim because it found a contract was formed, and that meant unjust enrichment was no longer a permissible claim. So it sent the case back for trial, and it sent the case back for trial on the only issue that it found that there was error and that it found that there was a sufficient factual showing. And the court said this twice. So just to set the stage here, I mean, the jury's note was very specific about the first invoice. It said, in order for the jury to put CFS in the position it would have been if the contract had not been breached, the jury believes The damages include all line items in the invoice dated 6/15/2007, that's the first invoice, minus legal fees. That's the note. And there were good reasons why the jury's note didn't mention the second invoice, because it was sent a year after the fact and no work product was ever provided to a Fremont from that invoice, as this court's opinion noted. And so in the earlier portion of the court's opinion, I'm looking at the portion that's on addendum page 49, where the court is considering whether there was a contract formed in the first place. The court again specifically said the jury's finding of a contract on the first invoice had reasonable support in fact. That was not true of the second invoice, and that's why the court didn't say it.
But Mr. Singer, if I might stop you there, I'm actually glad that you provided that summary, because I think that puts into context our statement in that opinion. We were addressing the fact that the district court erred by its response to the jury, and the jury had only focused, for whatever reason, had only focused on the first invoice. So our comments were for a new trial were based on the fact that based on the error that the district court made. We never said in that opinion that for in the new trial, the district court could not, or the jury could not address the second invoice. And we never said that a new trial is only limited to the first invoice. And Judge Burke made that very clear when she was looking at our order. When I look at our decision, I don't see any limiting language in there to that effect. I see comments that are made in the context of what had occurred with respect to the jury.
Well, Your Honor, but I think that the court's decision is based on the error that was made because of the finding that the jury made. And the only right. finding, and it's quite explicit about that, and in two places in the opinion. I don't know why the court would say we're remanding on the first invoice if it actually meant to remand on the first and the second invoice. And I think when you look at that statement.
But counsel, I think your point of, I think you're making my point for me is our court, the Court of Appeals, was responding to the district court's error of the jury verdict that only focused on the first invoice. So there was no need for us to say, address the second invoice at all. Our remand, our reversal was based on the district court's error, and our instructions were, you get a new trial.
Well, but the second invoice, Your Honor, was at issue in the appeal. And if the court had meant to remand on both invoices, it would have said so. And in fact, Judge Bush, in his opinion on unjust enrichment, specifically held that there was insufficient evidence that the work on the second invoice was performed. He didn't find that about the first invoice.
Finding has no bearing on the new trial. The new trial, it's a do-over. You get to start over on the damages issue, including the first invoice and the second invoice.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, I think you get to start over on the issues that are remanded to the court. And this court did not remand for a new trial on everything. It remanded for a new trial on the first invoice, and that's based on the reasoning that's expressed in the opinion about why it was remanding.
This is what bothers me about the unjust enrichment reversal. I understand you can't have both. If you're going to have a breach of contract, you can't have unjust enrichment. But the unjust enrichment issue was heard by the appeals court, and the basis for that, besides not being with a breach of contract claim, had to do with whether or not there was beneficial evidence. I mean, wouldn't that be allowed to be presented under the theory that was wrongfully shot down, which was breach of contract?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the entire claim for unjust enrichment was out. So any evidence that only related to unjust enrichment is out. If the same evidence, and a lot of the same evidence, I think, did relate to damages for the first invoice, that certainly was fair game in the retrial.
But perhaps I misunderstood you. I understood that you said that because there was a determination by Judge Bush that the second billing, the second invoice didn't confer any benefit on Mr. Land or on your client that in fact that it stayed that way, that it was of no benefit. I wasn't sure if we threw out the baby with the bathwater or how that was working.
Well, I don't think the court specifically threw out that finding. And in fact, that finding is perfectly consistent with the jury's finding, which was the basis for the court's opinion, which was that it's about the first invoice. The jury never bought the second invoice. Judge Bush never bought the second invoice. That part of the district court's original opinion judgment stood. And so the remand was about the first invoice, not the second invoice. And that's why the court said so twice. No reason for the court to say first invoice twice if it meant first and second invoice. It was not a mistake. So let me turn to the evidence of wealth. Evidence of the defendant's wealth is inherently prejudicial. This is one of the most well-settled principles in trial practice. And it was especially prejudicial in this case where the only issue in the case was damages, money. And the jury heard that the defendant has $300 million and that he has unlimited resources to pay for expensive lawyers. That's just beyond the pale. Now, CFS contends that the evidence was relevant to show the scope of the work that CFS was expected to perform. But if that were true, then the defendant's wealth and ability to pay would be admissible in every breach of contract case. And that's just not the law. The law is the opposite. The client's ability to pay does not determine what work the contractor should do. The contract determines what work the contractor should do. But in any event, even if we assume that it were relevant for the jury to hear that Efremov was financially well off, it was absolutely unnecessary for the jury to hear that he received $300 million, or that he paid a $1 million fine, or that he owns multiple homes, or that he hired expensive lawyers who represented President Clinton or Hillary Clinton or supposedly.
And Mr. Singer, as tantalizing as all of that is, you have another burden on the information or testimony as to wealth, and that's to show that the outcome might have been, could reasonably have been different. How do you even show that? How do you show that the outcome could have been different?
Well, I think once we get there, then the it seems a very easy step to say the jury heard all of this stuff about wealth. They heard all of this stuff about how Mr. Efremov hired expensive lawyers, all this politically charged stuff. To say that could not reasonably have influenced the amount of money the jury awarded to CFS on the case, I think just blinks reality. It's clearly prejudicial. Since the burden is actually not very high at this point, it has to have been a reasonable potential that it impacted the result. Clearly it did. And that was the intent of it, because the statements were obviously intended to prejudice the jury against Efremov and make the jury think of him as a rich fat cat. And that's especially so when you consider the evidence about the criminal case, which I'll turn to next. But I think just as a general proposition, to answer Your Honor's question, the jury typically doesn't explain why it reaches its verdict. So you have to look at the evidence as a whole. What was the case about? It was about damages. It was about money. What was the evidence that was put in? It was quite extensive. It was quite explosive. It was quite prejudicial. To say from that there's no reasonable chance that the verdict would have been different, where the jury ends up awarding $800,000+, every penny that CFS asks for, including on an invoice that there's absolutely no evidence to support, it was prejudicial.
So Mr. Singer, it just strikes me that perhaps your argument on why we should reverse the district court on the second invoice, because it's outside the scope of our remand, because, well, let's look, our previous decision in the Court of Appeals really relied in part, at least, on that note to the judge referring to kind of the $628,000 that they thought was appropriate. So we have a first jury thinking about that. Now we have a second jury thinking about that same number on the, on the first invoice and the second trial. You know, it just seems harder to then believe that all of this evidence about wealth or political connections really came into play. We have two juries here who wanted to award the same amount asked for on the first invoice. Help me with that.
Well, I think it's hard to imagine that a jury can hear this stuff, and particularly about the criminal case. And there was information on this at the first trial too, and not be influenced. So, you know, the jury in the first trial obviously didn't reach a verdict on the first invoice or the second invoice, which is why the court remanded for a new trial on the first invoice. Otherwise, it just would have entered judgment on the $600,000. So we have to look at the evidence in this trial, and the evidence in this trial, the actual relevant evidence here was pretty limited. But the CFS's counsel chose to load up the record with evidence about the criminal charges and about, well, I mean, look at the questioning of Mr. Efremov about the criminal charges. You were investigated by the IRS and the FBI and the US Attorney's Office, and you were indicted for 8 counts of mail fraud. And you know what mail fraud is, don't you, sir? And conspiracy to defraud the United States, and 6 counts of money laundering and forfeiture. And they tried to get 2 of your homes, and you hired the law firm that represented President Clinton. And you finish your closing argument by saying, Mr. Efremov couldn't remember that he had paid a $1 million fine. I had to remind him of that on cross-examination. I would ask that your verdict remind him of the $800,000 that he owes my client.
So, and I'll remind you, Mr. Singer, you'll need to sum up. Your time has run out.
Thank you. Just one more sentence. So he tied up together the criminal evidence and the wealth evidence in a neat bow for the jury that the defendant is rich and he's a criminal, so award all the damages we were asking for. And that's what the jury did. And Mr. Efremov did not get a fair trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll turn to Mr. Mattel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I represent Mark Lanterman and Computer Forensic Services, which, if it's all right with the court, I'll refer to as CFS. And I'd like to start with the remand issue. But before I do, I just like to address an elephant in the room. At least it's in my room. I was not involved in the trial of the first case, but I did help draft the briefs in the Court of Appeals on the first case. And that said, I feel a little awkward telling judges of the Court of Appeal exactly what their decision meant, particularly when one of the judges that was on that panel is here. So I just wanted to describe that elephant first. So with that said, that appeal centered on really 2 alleged errors that we contended that Judge Bush made. The first one was on Mr. Petrosinelli's letter to Mr. Lanterman, which was the contract. And then the second one was on, we contended that Judge Bush erred with respect to the jury instruction on costs. And this court agreed that both of those were error, and it held that the contract, Petrosinelli's letter, was a contract as a matter of law, and that he erred with respect to costs. There are 2 invoices here. They're the one on June 15, 2007, and another May 2, 2008. But it's important to understand the distinction between those because it gives context to what Your Honors did with respect to that decision. The first invoice had human time and computer runtime in it. And computer runtime naturally includes things like when you take in a hard drive or a USB stick or an iPhone to CFS, they will charge a per device rate for the computer running on that to image that if you want that back. That's one of the things, and that's very common with computer consultants, that everybody charges on a per device basis. So that invoice had a blend of computer time and computer runtime. The second one just had computer runtime. Judge Bush instructed the jury, costs under the contract just means human time. So it wasn't even, he just discarded the second invoice altogether. So when we were arguing this up to the Court of Appeals and your honors, we were saying, listen, let the jury determine costs under the contract. And that's exactly, and I can point, but I know your honors have read it, I can point to numerous different places in that opinion where you say we're sending this back to determine what the costs were. It would make no sense to send this case back for a retrial with respect to costs and limit that cost to the first invoice when that is exactly the sort of thing that Judge Bush did. So with that, I'll move to the next issue, and that's Mr. Efremov's criminal charges. He contends that we improperly proffered and Judge Burke improperly admitted evidence of the criminal charges against Mr. Efremov. But that evidence was critical to show why CFS did what it did and what it actually did. Now, Mr. Singer correctly pointed out, Mr. Efremov was indicted on 3 separate occasions, 1 first indictment and 2 supersedings, 18 crimes, mail fraud, conspiracy, false tax returns, and 5 counts of money laundering with extensive forfeiture allegations. It is in that context that Mr. Afimov's lawyers, Mr. Petrosinelli and Mr. Berman, reached out to Mr. Lanterman. Now remember, Mr. Lanterman was already the computer forensics expert on the underlying civil case, which led to Mr. Afimov's federal criminal investigation. So he knew about all that information already. But if the jury was not told of the nature of those charges, I mean, there are federal crimes for mutilating a coin. There are federal crimes for misappropriating the Smokey the Bear emblem. If the it matters to the jury to understand what exactly has been charged here in order to understand whether or not the amount of work that CFS conducted was appropriate. And in that context, we brought up about how, with respect to Mr. Petrosinelli's letter, who's Mr. Singer's law partner, they sent a letter there saying, just look at this stuff and we will pay your costs. There was no budget requested in that letter. There was no estimate even requested in that letter. And then Mr. Berman, right on the heels of that letter, told Mr. Lanterman, leave no stone unturned with respect to his search for documents that could help in Mr. Afimov's defense. Mr. Berman then got his friend to do a privilege review of the documents that Mr. Lanterman and his team harvested. That cost over $200,000 just to do that review. He was a witness that was provided by Mr. Afimov at trial. Now, his defense at trial was, we didn't use any of that. That's what you just heard here again with respect to that second invoice. We didn't use any of this stuff and it was all junk. Well, we countered that in two ways. One, by having Mr. Lanterman testify about how they seemed to like what he found. And second, we showed the result. The result that he got was probation to 18 federal crimes, which is a phenomenal result, which we all said. Now, the additional response to that, and one of the things here is that we're casting aspersions with respect to things that I allegedly said during my closing statement with respect to Mr. Afimov. And Your Honors, I would respectfully ask, if you have time, you know, sometime today, to look at page 15 of their reply brief and the second full paragraph in that. And I'd like to address it. He says CFS's counsel even asked the jury to speculate as to why Afimov was not in the courtroom, implying Afimov was a criminal who had knowingly exploited CFS's labor and was now embarrassed by his own refusal to pay invoices. And then they quote the transcript. Why isn't Afimov here? You know why he's not here. He knows he's got everything. Afimov's lawyers got their client a great deal, probation for 3-4, pleading guilty to 4 federal crimes. He's embarrassed to have to look Lanterman in the eye and say that you're not entitled to anything.
Mr. Now, Madden, let me interrupt you because I want to ask how you interpret the basis for this appeal. Reading the argument, it appears that they're objecting to the denial of the motion in limine to restrict that evidence. But there's also, it appears to be an argument that there was attorney misconduct despite the denial of the motion in limine. And is that how you read it also? And if so, what is your response to that as far as attorney misconduct?
Judge Werke, that's exactly how I read it. And that's exactly why I wanted to address what I was talking about on page 50 in the reply brief. If you read the actual transcript there, I was specifically talking about Berman and Petrosinelli. I did not say why Afimov wasn't there, because why? Afimov was there the entire time. And this is one of the things that Mr. Afimov and his counsel do repeatedly in their papers and have done to CFS outside of the courtroom. They malign, they obfuscate, and in this case, lie about what the transcript says. I did not do that. I did not say that because Mr. Afimov was there. And if you look at pages 521 and 522 and that second full paragraph on page 15 of the reply brief, you will see this lie that has been provided to Your Honors. Now, with respect to the attorney misconduct, again, there was no objection during closing statements. There was no objection during opening statements. Mr. Afimov was represented by what I believe to be a fantastic trial attorney, of Barbara Behrens. She is I've co-counseled with her and I've obviously been against her. We were co-counsel in a case in federal court before Judge Frank. I have the utmost respect for her. there was never any allegation of attorney misconduct on any of this thing. And one of the things that, frankly, I'm just a little tired of is these out-of-state lawyers coming in, throwing a hand grenade and leaving when doing this sort of misrepresentation in their briefs as to what I actually said. And that's one of the things that I would respectfully request with your honors is that this be addressed in your opinion. Look at that second paragraph on page 15 of the reply brief.
But if we address it in our opinion and you're telling me that there was no objection at trial, wouldn't that be blunted by Thiele versus Stitch?
I would be remiss to say that your honor is probably true. That's probably true. It was not addressed, but it has been addressed in this court. And that's what I'm saying is essentially what this court saying, listen, I don't want you misrepresenting what the record says with respect to Mr. Afremov's wealth, which we just heard about. I asked him two questions on page 146 of the transcript. Question, and you received approximately $300 million as part of that settlement. True? Answer, not quite, it was less. Question, was it around 300? Answer, close, not quite. Those were the questions I asked about his wealth. Everything else I asked was about the extensiveness of what he was doing with respect to his criminal defense. And the reason that I was asking that question is somewhat obvious because I have some personal experience with respect to my own practice. When a white collar defendant is facing these amounts of charges, there is one word that is usually not in their vocabulary, and that's the word cost. Freedom is, liberty is, but the word cost is not. And Mr. Lanterman had worked on this entire civil matter, knew all of this, knew the extensive nature of the charges, and was told by Williams and Connolly, we will pay all of your costs, and their co-counsel leave no stone unturned. That, to me, is exactly the sort of evidence that is contextual to let the jury understand why CFS did what it did and what it did. Your Honors, we won this trial because of Mark Lanterman's impeccable credibility, Mr. Afremov's dubious credibility, and Mr. Afremov's choice not to have Mr. Petrosinelli and Mr. Berman testify at the trial to say what the scope of the project was. That's why we won. We did not win because of some lawyer's cleverness or tricky sleight of hand. This was a fair trial conducted by a fair judge with a fair jury. And after hearing all that evidence, Judge Burke rendered a decision that, quite frankly, I think that order is so detailed, it has so many different citations to the transcript, and it is so well thought out that I'm sure your honors have experienced this on numerous occasions, but I need not submit a brief. I need not even talk here because that order, frankly, speaks for itself. And I think Judge Werke knows me well enough to know Judge Burke is a former federal prosecutor. It pains me to say how great a former federal prosecutor is because she is a fantastic judge. And this was a very, very fair trial. I really, frankly, enjoyed it because I really enjoyed the opposing counsel and I enjoyed the judge, but it was fair from beginning to end. And with that, I have nothing else to say.
Thank you. Mr. Singer, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it. Let me just start with the criminal issue. First of all, we are not claiming attorney misconduct. The issue here is that the district judge allowed the evidence to come in and that it was highly prejudicial and improper. We're not claiming that.
All right, that's an important point because I wasn't sure if that was being raised in your briefing. If you're submitting this as the denial of your motion in limine, then our analysis would be entirely devoted to that.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, it's a question of whether the evidence should have come in and whether it was prejudicial. And it's not a question of whether Mr. Maddal or anyone else did anything wrong. And the issue there, the answer is clearly the evidence should not have come in and clearly it was prejudicial. On the particular comment that Mr. Maddal mentioned, perhaps it was a reference to Mr. Berman and Mr. Petrosinelli as opposed to Mr. Afremov, but perhaps it wasn't, I don't know. But either way, the end result was the same. He's trying to say that Mr. Afremov got away with probation on all of these criminal charges. And so let's go back to the main point here, which is there was no reason the jury needed to hear all of these details about the criminal charges. Maybe the jury needed to hear that this was a serious case. That is as far as I would have gone. It was subpoenaed in a serious case. It could you could even go so far as to say, yes, it was a serious case where there were criminal charges and Mr. Fremov's liberty was at stake. Okay, I don't agree with that, but I could see that. To say that you need to go from there to say that he was charged with eight counts of mail fraud, six counts of money laundering, et cetera, forfeiture, you name it. That's just unnecessary, and there's absolutely no reason for it. And I didn't hear any reason for it from Mr. Madel just now either. And I think a lot of what I did hear, by the way, related to what was already decided in the first trial, which is a question of whether there was a contract formed. This was just a case about damages. It was supposed to be limited to the amount of damages, not about whether there was a contract, not about any statements that did or did not form a contract. And the suggestion, by the way, that somehow the result of the criminal case was relevant because of Mr. Lanterman's work, there is zero evidence of that. And in fact, the evidence is that none of Mr. Lanterman's work was actually used in connection with the criminal case. And on the second invoice, we didn't even get it. Fremont didn't even get any work product as a result of any work that Mr. Lanterman allegedly supposedly did. Okay, on the wealth evidence, very quickly. It wasn't just two questions to Mr. Fremont. It came up in opening statement where Mr. Madel said, Mr. Fremont bought his shares of the AGA company for $8 million and got $300 million. It was a pretty nice deal for him. So suggesting that that Mr. Fremont lucked into his wealth and so it's fine to take money away from him. It was used in the closing argument where he said he paid $1 million fine, remind him that he owes $800,000 to my client. It was over and over again. Finally, on the first invoice, the suggestion that the court was considering both invoices in connection with the contract is just belied by what the court said. And if you look back at page 12 of the court's opinion, and I too am reluctant to tell this court what it meant in a prior opinion. All I have to go on, and all any of us have to go on, is what the court said. When it reviewed whether there was a contract formed in the first place, it talked about the testimony from Lanterman, it talked about the testimony in the case. It then said, we conclude that the jury's finding that the discharge order covered CFS's first billing invoice has reasonable support in fact, based on the broad language used to define costs in the discharge order, the April 18th, 2007 letter and witness testimony. Didn't say that about the second invoice.
And then Mr. Singer, I think Mr. Madel raised a good point that we reversed the district court's decision because it misinterpreted the word costs and had created interpreted it very, very narrowly. And we said, no, that's not its meaning. The term cost would include a broader definition, would include both invoices, not just the first invoice.
Well, it could if the court had made that decision, but in fact, the court limited its decision to what had reasonable support in fact in the case. And it says that that's the first billing invoice. That's the exact words. And then when he gets—
Right, but we reversed the district court based on its definition and application and instruction to the jury regarding the word costs.
And the instruction was in response to the question the jury asked, limited specifically to the first invoice. It all ties back to the first invoice, which is why this court, I think it must be why this court said it twice. Otherwise, it just the opinion doesn't make sense on its own terms. It only makes sense if you think that the court was considering the evidence and the jury's note, all of which concerned the first invoice. Unless the court
Your time has run. Is there any other questions from panel judges? Thank you. I want to thank both attorneys for appearing in this manner and fashion. This is a voluminous file, but the briefs were very well done and the arguments were very enlightening and instructive. A decision will be made within the statutory time frame. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.